Welcome to the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast. Come join us by the tree. Should we be asking more of the pills that we take? There's a dark red pill that you can get for free and in bulk that, according to its distributor, will protect you from SARS and COVID-19 just by wearing it around your neck. If you ingest one of these pills may purge you completely from the inside. Another may induce a psychoactive vision of Gnostic knowledge that dwells within you. And one study claims that the taste alone is enough to liberate you from this world. The distributor promising these miracles is the office of the Dalai Lama. The study comes from the 11th century, out of the Nyingma school in Tibet. And the medicine in question is the mani, or jewel pill, an edible pellet consecrated through tantric liturgy and distributed throughout the world to this day in little plastic bags. Depending on which century of commentaries you search through for the recipe, the mani pill is a compound made from the flesh of a body that has been reborn 7 times as a Brahmin, or from the essence of the compassionate activity of Avalokiteshvara himself, or even from the excretions of the living Dalai Lama. For the scholar, the mani pill also mixes other materials that we otherwise tend to keep at arm's length. It is both a tributary gift and a religious relic, a political symbol, and a spiritual talisman. Its history entangles the material and the philosophical, recombining what academics sometimes divide as the culture of religion and the core. That may be why scholars haven't closely studied these pills, at least until our guest today first held them in his hand.
The pills often receive very little explanation. So that's something, I mean, the opacity of what this is to me, or that my lack of understanding of what that is, really compelled me to figure out, why am I receiving these? What do these do?
Yeah.
And so you can see that this kind of has flowered into a whole lifelong study, actually, this kind of curiosity.
On the podcast today, we'll hear about the results of that study and the book that sprang from that curiosity. We're recording from the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford, and I'm your host, Miles Osgood. My guest today is James Gentry, assistant professor of religious studies here at Stanford and a specialist in Tibetan Buddhism and its tantric traditions. James was previously on the faculty of the University of Virginia and an instructor at the Rongjung Yeshe Institute Center for Buddhist Studies at Kathmandu University, where he was director of its MA program in translation, textual interpretation, and philology. From 2015 to 2019, he was also editor-in-chief of the Project 84,000, Translating the Words of the Buddha. James received his PhD from Harvard in 2014 with a dissertation on objects of power in 16th century Tibet, and subsequently published Power Objects in Tibetan Buddhism, The Life, Writings, and Legacy of Sokdokpa Lodra Gyaltsen, with Brill in 2017. In 2019, he was the editor of a special edition of the Revue d'études tibétaines, the Tibetan Studies Review Journal, on Tibetan religion and the senses. More recently, James's study of Himalayan material culture and intellectual history has produced articles on sacred amulets and their boxes, the cannibal king Kalmashapada, and the color of Buddhahood in Great Perfection Theory, in venues that include the Journal of Contemplative Studies, the Rubin Museum of Art, the Rutledge Handbook of Religion and the Body, and the Journal of the International Association of Buddhist Studies. We're here today to talk about his forthcoming monograph, The Bodhisattva's Body in a Pill, which will be published by the University of Virginia Press this coming spring. So with that, let's head into the library.
So welcome, James.
Thank you so much, Miles, for having me.
Yeah, we're very excited about this. So I've gotten the chance to read the introduction to the book, which is exciting to get that preview. And it opens with a nice detail about a contemporary ritual that continues to be practiced by the office of the Dalai Lama, where little baggies of red mani pills are distributed to Tibetan Buddhists. And that's an origin point or a starting point for the book, but it sounds like it's also been an origin point and a starting point for your own Buddhist studies, your own research, that there was a point where you were traveling and researching where you were handed one of these bags and had to think about what that meant over the years. So could you take us back to that moment as a way of introducing yourself and tell us about why you were there, what you were interested in, how that maybe pushed you into the research direction you found yourself in?
Yeah, absolutely, Miles. Thanks so much for the question. Yes, I guess it goes back to a little over 30 years ago, if you can believe that, when I became very interested in Buddhism and especially meditation. So for me, my interest in Buddhism started really as somebody who wanted to learn how to meditate and to really get into the tradition that way rather than through a sort of scholarly approach. So, you know, not knowing that there were Buddhist centers, I mean, that was pre-internet really in a way, and not knowing that there were Buddhist centers in my neighborhood, I thought I had to travel all the way to Asia actually to meet meditation masters. So I did that, and I backpacked around Asia and, you know, met Tibetan lamas. And when sort of getting introduction to meditative practices, and especially in the tradition of the Great Perfection, where the emphasis is really on mind and the nature of mind, I was struck by something that happened always in those encounters, those teaching encounters, that after getting all of these really quite impactful meditation instructions that I could then go and you know, take with me and start practicing, I would be given an amulet or a little baggie of pills, and wasn't told much about them. But the same lama who gave me the meditation instructions and said, you should take these pills or you should wear this amulet, and these are very, very important. And so this kind of struck me at first as something that was maybe part of a cultural tradition, which it is, of course, of Tibetan Buddhist culture. But I really was struck by why. I mean, I just couldn't understand why I needed to take a pill or wear an amulet and how that had anything to do with the mind instructions that I was given. So that sort of drove me to think through the relationship. And I mean, decades later, that really resulted in trying to peer into how embedded they are with one another and looking into the textual tradition and the history of these traditions, seeing that that was in fact the case. So it was kind of set me off on a journey, I suppose, and trying to figure out what those material cultural elements had anything to do with the Buddhist tradition as I had kind of, you know, construed it or thought to appreciate it.
Understood it up to that point. Yeah, that makes sense. So I think we'll probably spend a good deal of this conversation answering that question why, by way of your various research. It sounds like that's been the animating question. But I wonder if maybe we should stop and pause on the what. First of all, sort of what are these objects? They, you know, fill out the book Power Objects in Tibetan Buddhism. You talk about stone cairns, you talk about sand mandalas, you talk about text amulets. And I know you've brought some things in for us today that you've collected that you can maybe describe, talk about, and show for us a little bit. Could you tell us about the whatness of these various physical objects that were handed to you or that are handed to other adherents, and maybe what they might indicate about a history?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I guess I'll start with the very first peculiar, at the time, object that I was confronted with. And I'll just reach down here and get it, because this is actually it. Back in 1994, as I was leaving Hilltop Hermitage in Kathmandu, that was owned, I suppose you could say, by a really famous Tibetan Lama who's since passed away, everyone in attendance was given this little booklet. So what this is it's the, it's called The Only Child of the Buddha's Tantra, and it's an actual tantra, a tantric scripture that's, you know, been printed in, it was printed in Hong Kong, and in gold on blue paper, as stipulated by the tradition that goes all the way back to the 12th, 13th century, and distributed to everybody in the audience after receiving these Great Perfection or Dzogchen mind instructions. And so we were all told, okay, well, this is really the encapsulation of the teaching that we had received, and we should just wear this. We weren't taught about it, per se, or told to recite it. But in researching it, I learned that there is a tradition of reciting it and even hanging it on the bodies of the deceased, and there's funerary practice associated with it. And it it describes the path of the contemplative path of the what's known as the heart essence or Ning Ti tradition of Buddhism, which is about eliciting visionary experiences of indwelling wisdom in order to reach Buddhahood. So there's a lot more to it, but that's part of another study that I'm doing at the moment, the history of this and other things like it.
Yeah, fascinating. So it sounds at some level that even if that wasn't explained to you, you'd be able to intuitively figure out, okay, I'm carrying a scripture around with me, a tantric scripture, something I could recite, something that I could imagine conferring blessings by nature of having some sort of content. Are there other things that require more kind of conceptual, abstract, artistic interpretation to make sense of?
Yes, very good question. that would be these kinds of things. I mean, here, I don't know if you can see the tiny little pills there, but and really getting no instruction whatsoever on what these are, but this is one of the, I suppose you could say, units of gift units mm-hmm. that you you would receive when meeting a Tibetan Lama in a traditional context, or even maybe here in California, actually.
Yeah.
So go and meet a Lama and ask a question, and you might get a little baggie of pills.
Yeah.
And a string to tie around the neck or the wrist, some kind of, and the string is often described as, okay, this is protection. The pills often receive very little explanation. So that's something, I mean, the opacity of what this is to me, or that my lack of understanding of what that is, really compelled me to figure out, why am I receiving these? What do these do?
Yeah.
And so you can see that this kind of has flowered into a whole lifelong study, actually, this kind of curiosity.
And is your sense that people living in Tibet who, you know, maybe their, you know, parents and ancestors would have also been familiar with this ritual, kind of have an intuitive sense or a cultural sense of what the pills are? Or is there a kind of deliberate sense of mystery withheld from the giver to the receiver?
It's both. There is a sense that people know what they are, that they're sacred pills, their dutsi in Tibetan, or their damtse, which means sacred substance, or even kind of binding substance. There's sort of two meanings to that term.
Yeah.
So there is a sense culturally it's highly valued, and there's a sense that they are coming from the lamas. Now the sense given to that, whether that's literally, you know, the bodily products of the lamas, or that's something that lamas are producing. Is somewhat murky, and it's not always known.
Yeah. I mean, partly the reason that I ask is that one thing that I was really struck by when I was reading Power Objects, and I think this comes up as well in the new book, is that it seems as though the kind of religious or cultural prestige or esteem that these objects have has also waxed and waned a little bit within Tibet. That, you know, you talk about Guru Chowang in the 13th century, creating the sort of mani pill tradition out of kind of a hybrid of multiple different sources, and we can get into that, and then being criticized by trans-sectarian scholars in the following centuries, or Sokdokpa Lodrog Yeltsin in the 16th century, then being disclaimed fully as a charlatan by the 5th Dalai Lama after having done this kind of ritual master practice. So I wonder, you know, has the knowledge been gained and lost over generations, or reclaimed and revived as Tibetans themselves have kind of had varying attitudes towards this practice?
Yeah, thanks for that. I would say that the actual practice of producing pills and distributing them, among wider audiences and consuming them, has been fairly constant over the centuries. But who is perceived as the purveyor and the producer of the most potent pills? And the ways in which those pills are produced, the valences given to them, the practice associated with their production, those kinds of things have been hotly contested over the centuries by different sectarian groups or individuals who want to be perceived as producing the most potent pills.
Oh, I see.
Or, those doctrinal elites who use Buddhist doctrine to kind of critique what they regard to be as excessive promises or claims of soteriology connected with those pills. Like, for example, the idea that you could just consume one and be delivered to a pure land.
Yeah.
Or put one into the mouth of an animal or a deceased person, and they could reach awakening in the next lifetime or what have you. Mm-hmm. So these kinds of claims have been contested doctrinally, but really, I think everyone was really, they were quite, negotiating with one another over, you know, who could be perceived as having the most powerful pills, and which institution could be in charge of producing those and distributing those.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's been fairly constant, but there have been many shifts historically because of these contestations.
I'm curious about the doctrinal side of it. I mean, certainly that aspect of sort of power games and, you know, who gets institutional esteem, where the religious hierarchy lies, that all makes sense. The reason the doctrinal side of it and the sort of philosophical side of it is of interest to me is because I know you've wrestled a little bit with other critics who also worry that this kind of fixation is maybe at odds with The sort of more philosophical, intellectual way that we might approach Buddhist studies more generally, that this kind of attention to material culture or to, you know, power objects with their, you know, supposed karmic or magic, you know, possibilities are in some way less rigorous or less core to what the religion really offers for meditation practices, for philosophical awakening. And it seems like this is a battle you've had to fight with contemporary scholars. Like, this is maybe a battle that has existed in Tibet in some form or another among the scholars of the living practice, but it seems like maybe in the academic world it exists as well. Is that right?
Yes, I would say absolutely. In terms of the role we should give them as scholars, whether to take them seriously and deserving of scholarly attention, and or whether we should kind of divert our attention or sort of focus more on what are considered to be, you know, the real meat of it, sort of the doctrinal issues, these kind of big ideas.
Yeah. So what is the status now of sort of the study of material culture and the study of philosophical culture and what they have to say to each other in maybe Buddhist studies in the last 10 or 20 years or the time that you've been studying?
Major shift has taken place, really. And I would say over the last 30 years. So Buddhist studies has really moved toward the material pole, and I guess that really inflects the larger sort of material turn in the study of religion that we're seeing across the study of religious traditions. Mm-hmm. But there's been a renewed interest in Buddhist studies, in studying things like the body and relics and places, pilgrimage places, and different kinds of material practices. But there's still, and I would say there's still a kind of shadow of a bifurcation between the so-called elite studies, which are still ongoing, you know, philosophical studies, doctrinal studies, and the study of material culture and artistic production and so forth. And there's little effort to kind of bring these together or integrate them holistically. I mean, it's still the case that when I tell some colleagues who are old friends and I value their work in philosophical studies, that I'm going to give a paper on an amulet, for example, in a Buddhist philosophy panel, that they roll their eyes and sort of say, they stop themselves short of saying, not this, you know, I can't believe it. Like, it's a sort of sign of the degenerate age or something that we're talking about.
So one answer to that seems to be to say that, the shift is already happening. And it's not just happening in Buddhist studies, but generally we've realized that this is a neglected feature of religions around the world that is just important. But it sounds like you're also saying that there's some value here in terms of integrating how we should understand what we have treated as purely intellectual or philosophical or spiritual with material practices that have always been tied up in them to begin with. I mean, we go back to your original story and say, you go on a pilgrimage, you go meditate, and you get handed this object. They are part of the same event, and they seem to be about the continuation of the work that you're doing that is spiritual or meditative. Is that right? So what do the materialists, as it were, have to say, you know, back to the sort of philosophical side of religious studies in terms of what benefit this is to them?
Often, I think at least, they too uncritically accept that bifurcation and say, okay, well, we're doing something completely different. So now we're really going to pay attention to the material side of things and how important that is, and the cultural and the social and so forth and so on. And rather than kind of push back against the dichotomy and, you know, take a step back and rethink the dichotomy between the elite and the popular, the doctrinal and the material, and these kinds of these kinds of dyads that sort of mark the field.
Yeah.
So I think there's still room to sort of push back on that bifurcation.
Yeah, interesting. And you mentioned the elite and the popular there. So it sounds like once you start to take bits away from one dividing line, there are other axes as well that feel a little bit less rigid, or a little less severe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the things that comes out of my study, because I study these things textually and not ethnographically, I think, is that I see that the great luminaries of the tradition actually were absolutely concerned with these things and writing a lot about them. So it's not that they're sort of somewhere in the corner in the tradition. They're front and center concerns for the main figures that are also studied philosophically and doctrinally.
Yeah, so this material culture is already a philosophical scholarly culture in its own time. Yeah,
absolutely.
So all this leads really nicely into The Bodhisattva's Body in a Pill, where you're thinking about the 1,000-year history of an object, but also a 1,000-year cultural, intellectual, philosophical history as well. What was it that motivated you, having already talked about a little bit the 7 times born Brahman idea and flesh pills, a little bit in Power Objects, that this particular object and this particular tradition needed a new book, and not maybe the pages you'd already sort of touched on it or approached it in your earlier work?
Yeah, that really it came out of Tsokdopa, so this figure that I studied for my first book and for my dissertation.
Yeah, tell us about him a little bit.
Really fascinating figure, and in that period that he lived, in the late 16th, early 17th century, mm-hmm. there were a lot of crises going on institutionally, and you could say in terms of sectarian strife. So there was a sense in which history became a focal point. So figures like Tsokdopa and others were writing a lot about tradition and trying to kind of reconfigure what it means going forward. So then writings from that period, not just Tsokdopa, but others, are really incredible lenses through which to kind of look to the past. So they give us a lot of source material, yeah. And they actually historicize the past themselves. So it was really following the leads of Tsokdopa Lhotogyeltsin and others of his time period, like the fifth Dalai Lama and other figures who were maybe not in agreement all the time, that sort of led toward rethinking, does it go back the way they say? And is it sourced? Are these traditions sourced in other kind of earlier traditions? And where does it go? And sort of just following the threads, basically, and kind of pulling at them,
yeah,
led to a kind of revelation after revelation in terms of where the pill tradition started and how far it could be traced back. And I had no vision of it at all as something that you could really tie together,
yeah,
as a sort of discrete set of traditions or even a discrete tradition that could be historically traced.
Yeah, so by way of one scholar, you get the invitation to go look at 1,000 years of history and see how well interconnected it is. And yeah. So, you know, I wonder about the slant that you mentioned he historicizes it in a particular way, and the slant that he gives it, and then what, you know, the ways in which you feel you have to go through the scriptures and correct the record or just establish kind of what that history was. Because the other thing that Tsokdopa, you mentioned, is fixated on at a moment of crisis is protecting borders in various ways,
yeah,
personal borders, spiritual borders, but also political borders. Does that inflect the way he thinks about what the pills are doing in his time? And then do you have to round out other things the pills meant at different times?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because in his time, the main valence of the pill for him was about power and martial power, essentially. So one of his gurus was said to be a 7 times born Brahmin, you know, whose flesh would be efficacious in turning back Mongol armies. If a stupa with his body interred were created at a particular geomantic juncture, you know. So that didn't happen. And so he attributes the Mongol invasions to that issue, that is, his students instead took his body to Bhutan.
Okay. So you didn't follow my advice and therefore
yeah,
and see, I was right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I had to look to other periods of time and what the pill uniquely meant in those other time periods for different individuals, struggling with different issues.
Yeah. So could you take us through what were some of those things? What did it mean at different moments?
Yeah. The pill tradition as we know it today really started in earnest in the 13th century with a figure named Guru Chukwuangchuk, or Guru Chuwang, that a lot of people know of him as one of the great treasure revealers of Tibetan history. And he was contending with, also with Mongol invasions, actually. So that was really the rise of the Mongol period,
yeah,
the Yuan dynasty and Mongol invasions in the 13th century. But with that came sectarian strife, as different Tibetan institutions were trying to play off different Mongol factions to further their institutional prestige. And at the same time period, there were epidemics, there were natural disasters, and basically social fragmentation. So his perception of the time period was one of decay,
yeah,
moral, ecological, political, and religious. And so for him, as far as I see it, the pill was about bringing people together, essentially. So he created temples at, you know, marketplaces and popular pilgrimage places, yeah. and sponsored mass pill production and consecration rituals, to which he invited not just Tibetans of all walks of life, but also Chinese and Mongolians and other people.
Yeah.
And yeah, different sectarian persuasions and men and women, children, the infirmed, everybody.
Yeah. And so maybe this is the point to ask, why a pill? And like, what is it about a pill in particular? So you mentioned decay and you mentioned epidemics. And from our modern perspective, we think therefore, okay, yes, a medicine. But you also mentioned sort of political danger and invasions and whatnot. A pill doesn't seem necessarily the most obvious, solution to all of that. So what is it? What is this object supposed to be?
Well, the 13th century, I think an important context for this is the 13th century was also the period when Tibetan medicine became much more pervasive across the plateau. So it's with the rise of Tibetan medicine and pill production overall was something that, you know, people were quite aware of. And with Mongol invasion and a lot of traffic through Tibet, there were epidemics. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were experimenting with different remedies and things like that. But a lot of people were dying.
Yeah.
So this particular pill, the Mani pill, is not so much for physical healing, but for access to Avalokiteshvara's pure land. Mm-hmm. So the way that the ritual looks is thousands of people gathered saying the mantra, actually, and not just Om Mani Padme Hum, but with Hri added to it. That was his special innovation, to add a Hri to the six-syllable mantra to create the seven-syllable mantra.
Which and means altogether...
Oh, it's Om Mani Padme Hum Hri. It has a meaning, but I mean, I guess roughly you could say that Mani Padme Hum, just it's, Om is sort of just, I guess you could say, beginning the mantra. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And has so much meaning that we could really go on forever about it.
Yeah.
But Mani means jewel. Mm-hmm. Pema or Padme means lotus, and Om Mani Padme Hum, the Hum is just another capstone mantra that has that's loaded with meaning.
Right.
And the Hri again, and these are things that they're seed syllables. The Om, the Hum, and the Hri connected with particular deities.
I see.
So the Hri is considered linked with a particular form of Avalokiteshvara.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really have any sort of Tibetan meaning.
But
Tibetans wouldn't really necessarily appreciate it as having any discursive meaning.
Got it. Okay. But adding extra emphasis or doing kind of what the Om and the Hum were doing at some level.
Yes.
With something added. Yeah. Okay. So we have this pill that gives us some kind of access to Avalokiteshvara and the Pure Land. That is not just a medicine, but some kind of grander protection and grander maybe soteriological salvation. Then, and that's in the 13th century, what is the fate of the pill going forward? What are other key moments for it?
Well, one of the aspects of the pill that Guru Chuan developed is that he combined medicinal substances with it that would have had purgative effects. So we're talking mass rituals, people taking the pill at the culmination of the ritual together, and either having an induced vomiting or diarrhea experience, basically, that would be indexing karmic purification. So you can imagine a kind of scene and this vulnerability that we create, and a kind of tantra commitments that would be received at that. So the binding people together in that sense.
Yeah.
So moving forward to the 14th and 15th century, some of those elements changed. The purgative medicinal element was toned down, and it entered the monastic sphere, basically. So we have it operating as a kind of interface between monasteries and the wider laity.
Yeah.
And that enabled it to cross sectarian boundaries and also kind of regional boundaries.
And this seems like a big part of the thesis of your book, right, is that we might imagine that when you have the experience, as you had, of going on your own meditation practice, looking for something personal and being handed these pills, that fundamentally what they are offering you is something personal and individual about your own meditative practice, about your own karmic salvation, however you want to think about it. But what you're seeing throughout history seems to be something that is more social, more about, more political, maybe even more geopolitical, about the ways these pills bring people together. Is there some way that, what would we say about that in the contemporary moment? What social role does it seem to be playing now?
I think a really important one for Tibetans in diaspora and in Tibet still, because this is a tradition actually that the 14th Dalai Lama, the current Dalai Lama, started to do again in exile. So it was revived essentially, and it was something that was done in Tibet, but then there was a kind of cleavage, and so it was reintroduced in the diasporic context. Not that long ago, a few decades ago, you could say for doing a lot of things, but one of the, they're highly valued by Tibetans, basically.
Yeah.
So Tibetans in Tibet are not really permitted to carry photographs of His Holiness, for example. So mani pills function as a kind of surrogate for representations of his presence, his photographic representations, because they're consecrated by him.
Yeah.
So they're in a sense considered a concentrate of his salvific beneficial power.
Yeah.
So, you can go on eBay actually and they're being sold, but the Dalai Lama gives them away for free. So they're produced annually in the month of Sakadawa, the Tibetan, the fourth month, which celebrates the awakening of the Buddha, basically, and other things. But then they're distributed free of charge, and there's just hundreds of thousands of them. And so people line up, and you can actually see there's footage available on YouTube of the event of when they're first made available. And they are truly some of the most prized items that you can bring friends when you visit China, Tibetan friends who want them, or Tibetan friends who live in Toronto, or Tibetan friends anywhere around the world. So to me, they have this function of kind of in the absence of any actual state authority, sort of reviving, in a sense, the traditional prerogative of the state in extending the blessing of the Dalai Lama, healing blessing of the Dalai Lama to the Tibetan people.
So it sounds like, in fact, you're invited or at least welcome to gift the pills further forward, and thereby kind of extend the social reach of who is in this community together, tracing back to the compassion of Avalokiteshvara or back to the body of the Dalai Lama, and thereby having some kind of node in common from where these pills came. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's a kind of social network that's created through that. But then I think that's rooted in, you can sort of think back historically to these big consecration events, some of which were attended by, thousands and thousands of people, actually, and lay people and people from all walks of life in Tibet. And they would culminate with actually ingesting the pill together. So you can see, this kind of commensality that is, in a sense. And then the tantric commitment that would be bestowed upon them that they share. And so it's this kind of a global extension of that, I would say.
Yeah, what a new life for that to take, to have, the ability to disperse itself around the world, not only as pills, but almost as seeds, as opposed to the thing that you take a pilgrimage for to go and ingest and leave there, as it were. So different than the way that we often think of relics and reliquaries and maybe stupas, where you have to go to a particular place and worship it there and therefore join community there, but rather, to allow something to spread outward.
Absolutely, yeah. The portability of it really transformed the way that the kind of function that it can have, I think.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So an ongoing life and an ongoing set of mutations of meanings, it sounds like. One thing that I wanted to close on was to ask you a little bit about where your own research is heading and mutating. You mentioned when we talked before that, as part of your work, kind of combing through these archives, overseeing perhaps as an editor translations that are happening, participating in your own translations, you just get deep into the records of Tibetan Buddhist scripture that maybe, some of which maybe have gone lost. And, I'll let you tell this story and this research a little bit more for yourself, but just to tease it a little bit, that there's long been a consensus, against the sort of snooping curiosity of the West, maybe, that that oh no, Tibetan Buddhists or Buddhists generally didn't have an interest in the kinds of meditative experiences that maybe, you know, Americans were trying to combine with psychoactive drugs in the 60s and beyond. That's just something we're projecting backward and imagining that they might have done. But no, it turns out, actually, maybe there are attempts to have tried and experimented with those kinds of experiences dating to the 13th and 14th century. So could you tell us a little bit about what you found and where you're headed with that research?
Yeah, thanks very much for that. I just presented on this actually at a conference at University of Virginia this last weekend. So it's very exciting. Funny, it's that it's a commentary on this tantra. So the tantra that's in this amulet.
Yeah.
There's a commentary on it that's attributed to a figure named Garab Dorje, who can be dated to quite early, 6th-7th century, but I'm pretty sure it's actually from the 13th, 14th century, from text internal evidence. And there you have pill recipes for, the way it's put is to eradicate attachment to the senses by disrupting ordinary sensory experience. Mm-hmm. So the way that these pill recipes go is that you gather together ingredients, bury them until fungi form, and then cultivate that fungi and form pills out of them and take them with the expectation that your field of vision transforms. Yeah, so there's considerable evidence that contemporary meditators or modern meditators have taken psychoactive substances that are available, you know, on the Tibetan plateau or in India to kind of test their realization, the stability of their realization. And so we find this in biographical and autobiographical materials from the current age. But there's been this idea, that nobody did that as an integral part of the Buddhist path, actually, that that's something that we're, imposing, as you said, from our vantage point. It's a kind of anachronism. But the text, the commentary on this only child of the Buddhist tantra.
The amulet you were looking at before.
Yeah, the amulet that we were looking at, this blue and gold amulet, stipulates precisely that we are to, gradually induce visionary experiences that lead to sort of grander visionary experiences that index an indwelling gnosis within our bodies, but that as a preparatory phase, we can cultivate fungi and form them into pills and take them. And it's quite interesting because the visionary experiences to be induced from the fungi map to the 10 kashinas of the Pali tradition. So this is sort of a 10, you could say, concentration practices where you take one or another object as a focal point, like earth and water, and the elements are there, or certain examples of the elements and colors, and focus on them until your entire field of vision is transformed into that as a kind of way of gaining mastery in concentration meditation. So these sort of psychedelic versions of it that we find in Tibet map quite closely to those in the details, but you're using a fungi to kind of elicit the experience rather. And you're not supposed to stop there necessarily, but this is for, as the text puts it, gradually kind of training oneself or cultivating oneself in the visionary experiences that index a kind of indwelling wisdom towards awakening. So they're framed as precisely integral to the Buddhist path in ways that we thought were just not present in the traditions.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's another way of training yourself or opening yourself up to different kinds of mentalities as opposed to something that you return to over and over again. You're not doing the fungi-based pills every time to reattain the same experience. Is that right? It's more to get a glimpse.
Yes, that's exactly how it's framed, as something that that you do as a preliminary.
Yeah.
If it's difficult to elicit the visions without them, you can do it to kind of get a glimpse into what's possible.
I see. And you talk about other experiments too that are related to this, right? In terms of using sensory deprivation, maybe these are other access, other ways of kind of playing with the visual. So what other things have you discovered there?
Yeah, that is kind of part of the mainstream tradition, as it were, of the heart essence of the great perfection, where you would, and sort of the fungi cultivation and ingestion is framed as something as a preliminary to these sorts of visionary experiences, where what you do is You do sky gazing, sort of at oblique angles to the sun, and manipulating, your eyes and using masks and so forth, or complete sensory deprivation, where you just stare into the pitch black darkness in a special enclosure, in order to elicit the same visions. And sometimes you can alternate between these, or create a sort of gray rooms that are sort of dappled light, in order to manipulate light sources to create visual effects.
Yeah. Wow. And one more way in which the pill has been used and conceived, and things you could put into the pill, it sounds like, that I hadn't even realized. Well, that's fascinating. So it sounds like from power objects to the pill, and then on to this, there is more to this history to be uncovered. There are more to these texts to be uncovered. And so we all look forward to hearing about that, to seeing how that talk evolves into more published work. Well, thanks so much, James, for doing this conversation with us and sharing all your research. It's great to have you with us and to have you around Stanford.
Thanks so much, Miles. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to James Gentry for joining the show. You can now pre-order The Bodhisattva's Body in a Pill from University of Virginia Press online. And check out the first few minutes of the video of this interview on YouTube if you want to see close-ups of the Mani pills and the text amulet. We always close with Ani Choying Drolma's chant of Om Mani Padme Hum, as recorded at Stanford in 2017, but today maybe you'll listen to it and imagine a seventh syllable, the Shri, that James mentioned. As you heard, that seventh syllable was the addition of Guru Chowang to invoke Avalokiteshvara and the seven times reborn Brahmins for the mass pill consecration rituals of the 13th century. Until next time, this has been the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast.